This is the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. This week we're going to be discussing all things UKIP and the EU referendum. In many ways, you could be forgiven for not being quite sure where to place UKIP right now. On the one hand, they failed to make a significant breakthrough at the general election, in terms of seats at least. Their leadership has been beset by resignations that weren't, and conflict between Douglas Carswell and Nigel Farage in terms of who should lead the party. On the other hand, UKIP did achieve around almost 4 million votes last May and may blame the electoral system rather than their own performance by, you know, for how many seats they have and with some justification. They've also got the referendum on Britain's membership of the EU that has for long been the raison d'etre of the party. But what happens next, and just how big a part of this Leave campaign should UKIP and specifically Nigel Farage play? And what does the future hold beyond that campaign for UKIP? Lots of questions to mull over there, and I was pleased to be joined today by Professor Matthew Goodwin of the University of Kent to discuss these further. Matthew, of course, being the co-author of the 2015 political book of the year, Revolt on the Right, and also the co-author of the more recent book on UKIP, titled UKIP Inside the Campaign to Redraw the Map of British Politics, which I should say is essential for anybody listening to this podcast who I would assume would therefore be interested in these things, along with others. Matthew Goodwin is one of the sort of foremost experts on the rise of UKIP, and you know, therefore, you know, his views on their future will be very interesting. I was also joined today by Rob Vance, as usual, and we talked a little bit about the polling around the EU referendum and which way we think that campaign might go. But before we crack on with today's podcast, a couple of other things to mention. The first thing is to say a big thank you for everyone listening last year. Something that I tweeted about recently, which we announced, but also I don't think I actually mentioned on air, so to speak, is that the podcast made the top 10 on Podbean, which is the site on which this is hosted, out of 120,000 podcasts for the whole of 2015 on for news and politics. So obviously, you know, delighted with that. We've also recently made the top 50 on iTunes as well. So that's all to do with people downloading and sharing and, you know, really sort of supporting the podcast. And, you know, thanks everyone for doing that. It's very much appreciated. And obviously we don't get money out of this or anything like that. It's very much a labour of love. So it's great to know that so many people listen to it. And also we had a lot of new listeners for last week's podcast with Damien McBride, which if you haven't listened to already, you should. It's really interesting to get Damien's views on the reshuffle and the future of the Labour Party as someone that's been there you know, in the past. Obviously, that had 31,000 downloads, which is actually the fourth highest we've ever had. So, you know, really, that must obviously mean that new people have been listening to the show. So thanks very much. But before I prattle on, let's crack on with today's episode. And I started off by asking Matthew Goodwin what he thought about the current state of UKIP as we look ahead to the EU referendum. So, Matthew, before we look at the EU referendum, I wanted to talk a bit about UKIP. With the research you've done, obviously the books you've written, where do you see the party right now?
Well, I think the party is very much at a crossroads. Those at the top of the party around Nigel Farage are trying to work through a decision, which is whether UKIP really wants to be focused solely on the EU referendum and trying to deliver Brexit versus UKIP becoming a fully fledged domestic political party that campaigns around immigration, national identity, and that similar cluster of issues that has sustained the radical right in many other European democracies for 20 or 30 years. And that crossroads, I think, is reflected both in the party's reaction to the 2016 elections, where you can see a significant amount of activity going on in Wales in particular, perhaps less activity than you might expect in the English local elections, which I think would be particularly promising for UKIP were they to take those seriously, especially in the northern metropolitan council areas. But also, of course, in this big referendum that's on the horizon, and you know, UKIP's destiny as such, if it decides to try and build a presence beyond that, is going to be, I think, heavily influenced by how close that result is, and you know, whether UKIP is able to emulate an SNP type effect by pulling a larger section of the electorate than 10 to 15% around its flag. And that is the party's challenge.
Almost victory from the jaws of defeat, maybe, if the referendum doesn't go their way. I mean, Rob, what's your sense of... how satisfied do you think UKIP are right now as to where they are? Because I suppose, on the one hand, if you look at the general election, there was just the one seat that they held in the end, Douglas Carswell's, obviously. Nigel Farage didn't manage to make Parliament. But at the same time, it was almost 4 million votes. So, you know, on the you can make an argument for both ways in terms of how well they've been doing recently. At the same time, there's trouble at the top, isn't there, in terms of, as Matthew says, in terms of the direction of the party. I mean, what's your sense of how satisfied would you be if you were a senior UKIP person at the moment?
I think you'd be very satisfied, probably, with 4 million votes. I think you'd be very frustrated with the electoral system, though I don't think they've made quite as much of a song and dance about that as you might have expected. I mean, you know, the Lib Dems were always quite in favour of electoral reform anyway, but not least because it didn't do them any favours in terms of parliamentary seats. I think, you know, they can feel fairly aggrieved about potentially not having support in the House of Lords that their 4 million votes might suggest that they would get. And so I think there's a sort of constitutional and institutional thing which is important. But on the other hand, you know, the places where you might expect them to be, you know, focusing, like the English local elections, I think they probably, in the past certainly they've found it challenging to find good candidates for local elections, and I think that probably continues to be a challenge for them. It's one thing to have a national figurehead in the form of Farage and actually some other, you know, MEPs who have high profile as well, you know, have those kinds of people being able to, you know, project the party's thing on a national media thing, but it's quite a different one to have that at a local level, and I think that will continue to be a challenge for them. But in terms of on the ground, what's surprising is Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party creates an enormous opportunity, I would have thought, for the party in terms of, if you like, a traditional white working class base in lots of areas that, you know, lots of evidence suggests isn't wild about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and, you know, doesn't necessarily share those, you know, what might be crudely, you know, characterised as sort of, you know, Islington, champagne, socialism values, whatever. But I think there's various policy things that UKIP might need to consider doing in order to attract that support, that potential support that they're perhaps not going to do. And this reflects to some extent the dilemmas that, you know, Matthew was describing in terms of...
I want to come back to Matthew. I mean, I suppose you were very much vindicated, Matthew, in the work you've done when there was a debate about whether UKIP was more of a threat to the Conservatives and Labour shouldn't really worry. And I think one of the things you've been mentioning for a long time is that, you know, UKIP's just as much, if not more, a threat to Labour's long-term prospects than the Conservatives. I mean, do you still feel that in terms of, if you look forward, is there one of the two main parties that should be most concerned about UKIP?
Well, I think just briefly, if I may, Rob made a really key point there, which was around UKIP's weakness at local elections, and that is absolutely true. I've just done some analysis with Michael Thrasher at the University of Plymouth, and we found that, you know, one of UKIP's big problems is it grew very quickly from 2013 onwards, but that didn't leave it a lot of time to actually prepare for a general election. And because it grew so quickly, a lot of the people that it attracted, we found, had very little experience in politics, never mind running a professional targeted constituency campaign. And that tension or sort of that Achilles heel, if you like, within UKIP really is an important part of its failure to win seats. But when we also look at UKIP's development at the local level, that's where you can see it really picking off votes, especially from 2014 onwards in Labour areas. And as we show in the book, UKIP's rise is an integral part of the story about why Labour really failed to come back electorally. And I think looking forward now, if you take the most, you know, what we would call UKIP-friendly constituencies, the vast majority of those constituencies are in Labour areas, heavily working class, economically left behind, feeling cut adrift from Westminster. And I think what you're beginning to see, even in Oldham, which was undoubtedly a disappointment for UKIP, essentially the party is reordering the opposition within those seats, is emerging as a second political party behind the Labour Party and sucking in, if you like, lots of Lib Dems, perhaps some disillusioned Conservatives, perhaps some former Labour voters. The question now is, you know, how much does UKIP want to throw at that strategy? The vast majority of seats, for example, that UKIP targeted at the general election were Conservative-held seats. Nigel Farage might have talked about parking his tanks on Labour's lawn, but actually when you look at the 32 seats that we list in the book, actually there's only around 8 of them that are Labour-held. So they didn't throw everything they had at that strategy. And I think as a consequence, some of the seats that they chose were not ideal, and they got hit as a result of that. But in May, you know, if this were a party that was trying to emulate, for example, the Danish People's Party, which has done incredibly well by targeting socialist areas, UKIP would be throwing everything it had at those northern metropolitan areas. At the moment, my reading is that they're not doing that.
I mean, what do you make of Nigel Farage's leadership? Because I suppose there has been trouble at the top. I think Douglas Carswell has at the very least alluded to a requirement for or a need for a change in leadership at the top. He is someone that's very popular in some parts, but also incredibly divisive as well. One assumes he doesn't go on forever. I mean, what's your take on his leadership? And I mean, if he was to stand down, maybe after a failed EU referendum, although he stood down before, of course, where does UKIP go from there? Because presumably that cult of personality is quite important, isn't it?
Well, I remember Nigel Farage telling us during one interview that he likes to be he likes to come in as the leader of UKIP when the stock price is low, and he likes to leave when the stock price is high. And on that basis, I think if the Leave vote were to poll reasonably strongly at the referendum, I think you'd expect after that to see Nigel Farage standing down and perhaps finally leaving the landscape of British politics. The question then is, you know, very much where does UKIP go after Farage? There is no question that he is a major driver of the UKIP vote. However we cut the numbers, however, whatever survey data we use, and this is an unpopular point to make, but Nigel Farage is an asset for UKIP. He really does drive their vote. And one of the key dilemmas that the party now is going to face post the referendum, assuming Farage does go, is who steps into that space. Is it Paul Nuttall, who wants to go very much down the lines of the European radical right, talking about Islam and immigration? Is it somebody like Stephen Wolfe, who perhaps talks about a more softer, moderate type of political party that's not perhaps emulating the Farage model? I think when you look at the party and you look at the National Executive Council in particular, most of those people, not all, but most, are Farage loyalists. So essentially, whoever he nominates as his successor will most likely end up taking his place. It could well be somebody that we don't even know yet. And during several conversations with Farage, he's alluded to that the next leader of UKIP may not currently be in UKIP.
So I want to move on to the EU referendum briefly. I mean, I suppose one of the big debates here is about the role in which both Nigel Farage and UKIP should play in that. Obviously, it's their raison d'etre, or at least was once upon a time, so they're going to be very, very, very active. But I suppose if you're running the Leave campaign, there is a dilemma there. But before we go on to that, I mean, Rob, the polling itself, in terms of where we see that referendum campaign going, seems to be quite ambiguous, doesn't it? On one hand, a lot of the online polls seem to show a neck-and-neck race, yet some of the telephone polls, which are granted often less frequent, seem to be showing Remain comfortably in the lead. I mean, where do you see that role and that race lying, and what do you think is driving it?
So I think there's two... First of all, on the methodology point, I think there's sort of broadly two theories, two schools of thought about why that might be. On the one hand, you've got a version of what we've talked about before for the general election of, you know, it being difficult to get hold of a representative sample in online panels. So perhaps there's an overrepresentation in online panels of people who are more engaged with the issue, and that slightly breaks towards people who are in favour of leaving, in terms of, you know, there being an energised base that's very engaged in politics and very strongly believes in leaving the EU, which could be slightly overrepresented. It certainly seems that from the Ashcroft polling, where he did, I think, 20,000 interviews or something, and he asked a rather strange question, but part of that question was about, you know, how strongly you feel about it. And there was a big, big tail in terms of, you know, those who were, you know, 100% in favour of leaving, so that certainly would have reflected there. On the other hand, there could well be a bit of a, you know, social desirability bias, a perception that saying that you want to leave the EU is perhaps slightly socially less desirable to a telephone interview. So there could be a bit of a social desirability bias going on. I'm not sure that is the case, but I think it could be a small element of both bits. So whereas in the general election we saw that actually phone and online were broadly speaking in a similar place, where they were quite different was actually in terms of UKIP vote. And I think these related factors are probably, you know, to some extent quite related. But in terms of where I think the actual referendum question is, I think remaining in is just ahead. But I think turnout is going to be super important. important, and part of that is about organisational capability, and goes back to some of the things that we were talking about earlier in terms of whether the Leave campaign have the kind of organisational capability to turn people out. But also, you know, they do have a big challenge. You know, I think at the moment there's a sort of slightly sort of phony war going on with Cameron involved in negotiation rather than being what we presume is going to be the case of him coming out and saying, I think we should remain in, and I've negotiated this deal and I want you to all go out and vote for it. And I feel like things might well change there. So I think at the moment...
He's going to be very important, isn't he? Because at the end of the day, if we assume David Cameron backs Remain, which is the assumption, I don't think anybody really seriously thinks he's going to campaign for Leave. Yeah. That's the Prime Minister, whatever you think of him, that is the Prime Minister of the country recommending a course of action, which is a very powerful argument for the status quo.
But, you know, and we've seen some of this already, but, you know, it's likely to be the Prime Minister, I'm guessing something like 90% of the CEOs of the FTSE 100, the leaders of all three main, you know, the three major political parties, you know, actually four political parties if you include the SNP. So, you know, that's a pretty big uphill challenge for those that want to leave once, in effect, the full campaign starts.
But let's not forget that there have been EU referendums in Europe where the entire establishment, political, media and business elite have lined up to tell voters that they should support the EU option, and voters have essentially put their middle finger up at the quote-unquote establishment. I agree there are some massive hurdles facing the Leave camp, not least the Cameron effect. It's not only in the straight cross-sectional polls that you can see him when voters are given a Cameron cue that he's recommending a Remain vote, that support goes up. But we also find in our online experiments that Cameron also nudges Labour and Lib Dem voters. They become more likely to want to remain. Mm-hmm. And when you combine him with business, and there is one question that does this, that voters are presented with a scenario where David Cameron is recommending Remain in, as are several big businesses who are saying they'll have to relocate abroad, the race isn't even close. So suddenly is a large margin opening up. And I guess the question I would ask the Leave camp is this. If after the refugee crisis, if after the attacks in Paris, if amid unemployment levels of 11% across the Eurozone, you have still not established a consistent lead in any of the opinion polls, is it perhaps the case that something is not quite connecting as it should do? Because the unwritten law, and of course referendums are notoriously volatile, but the unwritten law is, you know, as we get closer to the vote, in general terms, voters become more risk-averse and more in favour of the status quo.
I mean, who do you consider, if you've looked at this, the swing voters in this race to be? Because I was reading a paper by, I think John Curtis led on, certainly I think there was a number of people that worked on it before Christmas, which looked at a lot of common sense findings, to be honest, around, you know, the people, older people tended to be more in favour of leaving, so did, there was a sort of education correlation as well, whereas the kind of younger graduates who maybe felt more secure in the labour market and more comfortable with immigration were much more in favour of remaining, whereas the flip side, you know, those people that maybe feel a bit left behind were in favour of leave. But it feels to me just intuitively that those people, and maybe even the older voters who are maybe more sceptical of the new age in which we live, maybe won't be enough to deliver that 51% that they would need to have a Leave vote. I mean, do you agree with that? And if so, who do you think the swings are that the Leave campaign has to convince?
Well, I think turnout is going to be a massive factor in the differential impact that these groups have. If the Leave camp falls heavily dependent upon the angry old white man, it's going to be difficult to assemble a majority position, assuming the other groups turn out to a decent extent. They're going to have to make inroads into, you know, the middle age and middle classes, those university graduates who typically have remained out of bounds of Euroscepticism for much of the past 30, 40 years. And that's going to be a difficult task. I think a lot of that will be around actually not banging the immigration drum, but making a plausible, credible case for what Brexit looks like. Mm. And what would make me nervous, I think, if I were a Leave activist, is that many of the senior campaigners are still very reluctant to set out that credible alternative, because from their point of view, a strategic point of view, they argue that that's a trap. The moment they do that, as Alex Salmon did, the alternative case will be ripped apart. But when you look at those undecided voters, as Lord Ashcroft did, they break typically around 61 to 39 in viewing Brexit as the greater risk. Now, the undecideds are around 18 to 20% of that vote. If they break in a majority for Remain, this will not be close.
Mm. And then, of course, David Cameron supporting Remain only is going to accentuate that potentially.
And then you've got the David Cameron effect, which will need to be neutralised by a Boris, by a Theresa, perhaps by all of them put together, and it still might not be enough. So the Leave camp certainly has the biggest challenge, and it has to deal head on with this issue of voters feeling that Brexit is a riskier option.
I mean, Rob, you work a lot in messaging, of course, for various clients, political or corporate. I mean, what's your take on some of that? Because, I mean, ultimately, it does seem like immigration is the real issue that is probably making this a debate in the first place, because there is, it's a huge issue. It's either been number one or two in terms of the issues indexes that we look at the moment. But at the same time, it isn't enough, is it, to be able to convince people to vote to leave the European Union, which at the end of the day is quite a big leap to actually do.
Well, I mean, I think, but what you see is this, is there's a certain extent to which this has been reflected in the two different leave campaigns. So one seems to be trying to accentuate, if not necessarily what the future will look like under Brexit, but certainly this is a kind of the sunny uplands. This is, this is hope. This is what we can do with the money. This is about hospitals. This is all that kind of argument. And certainly, I totally take Matt's point about if you're running a referendum campaign, if you're going to win, you need sort of two things. You need to both be the optimistic, kind of Obama-like, there is a new tomorrow kind of on the side of that. And you also need to make it a shoving two fingers up at the establishment if the establishment is reined against you. But it's actually quite hard to square that circle in terms of bringing those two arguments together, which is where I think, as you say, someone like Boris is, who does the kind of sunny uplands, bonhomie optimism thing pretty well. Some of the campaign that's already doing that in terms of what Brexit looks like, saying that they'll spend the money on, hospitals or doctors or whatever else it might be, rather than banging on about immigration, which I think, as we saw in the general election in 2015, if we're talking about, middle-aged women with families and so on as being a kind of core swing group, then I think most of the evidence suggests that they're likely to be more swayed by, things about economic security and, being risk-averse than they are about, sort of perhaps what Nigel Farage goes on about, which is where I think Nigel Farage becomes quite his polarising character. And I accept he's an asset to UKIP in terms of getting up to 4 million votes, but you need a lot more than 4 million votes. Mm. And, this is where we end up in a situation not unlike, I would suggest, the SNP in Scotland, where Alex Salmond was very, very good at getting up to wherever it was, 40% and so on, but actually it was Sturgeon that was able to win the majority of those seats. Sure. Imagine what the referendum might have been like had Sturgeon been in charge rather than Salmond.
At the same time, I suppose, it sounds like we're sceptical of the chances of leave, understandably so. It's fighting against the status quo, but events can always conspire, can't they? Terrorism, another refugee crisis.
Collapse in the economy.
Collapse in the Eurozone.
Or the British economy, I think, probably even more important than the Eurozone.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of assumptions around, events to avoid events. But, I mean, if you look at the Paris attacks, a lot of the sort of Eurosceptics, we're not sort of, happy about that, obviously. But I think many felt that that would move in their favour. Look at the polling since then. Look at some of the academic research that's been done since then. There was no real benefit for the let's just get out of this thing, it's out of control argument. I think it was far more, if there was an effect, I think it was actually leaning slightly the other way. And I think if there were an economic collapse, it would actually be quite easy for the Remain camp to say, well, let's not face the risk of even further economic turmoil at this point in time. Let's stand with our European trading partners, etc., etc. I think, you can spin these arguments obviously in different ways, and one of the things that we find, at least in our experiment, is that positive arguments certainly carry a lot more weight than negative arguments when it comes to this EU referendum.
I'm interested in exploring the last sort of 5 minutes, the potential impacts of this referendum campaign. I mean, we look back at Scotland, and of course the SNP very much lost the battle, but maybe not won the war that they wanted to win, but they certainly, obviously there was a landslide in Westminster. One of the narratives that people do put forward is that UKIP might do something similar, where they lose the referendum in terms of Remain prevails, but actually in doing so, maybe they find themselves on the right side of the argument for a lot of Labour voters or a lot of Conservative voters or even MPs. What's your sort of perceptions on that? I noticed you had a piece in the Telegraph recently where you suggested that there are pitfalls for the Labour Party in this referendum campaign.
There are big challenges for Labour because they're going to spend potentially the next 6 months or a year telling working class voters that the EU is a good thing and EU migration is a good thing, and Europe is an issue that cuts across their traditional electorate. So the voters that didn't turn out for Labour last May and the voters that they need if they're ever to have an electoral comeback, well, they think very differently than the London-based Labour MPs on Europe. They don't like it. And I think that is where there is a big opportunity for an anti-establishment alternative. UKIP's big dilemma is, firstly, organisational. Does it have the money and the manpower to actually stage an SNP effect? I'm somewhat sceptical now that it does, looking at, for example, the party's development since the general election. I think it's missing several big opportunities, the English local elections, namely one of them. But secondly, I think also there's going to be this big question mark. Do we see a big UKIP rebrand after the referendum, right? Where the UK Independence Party actually becomes, I don't know, the Freedom Party, the kind of European type, patriotic, nationalist, you know, at some points, you know, overtly anti-immigration movement that tries to draw together a different, slightly bigger constituency that we've seen in Denmark and Austria and so on, and, you know, even historically liberal countries like Sweden are seeing 20% plus, you know, voting for the Sweden Democrats. There is a future for UKIP. The question is whether UKIP actually wants to take that future and whether it's able to kind of wean itself off its rather a slim diet of Nigel Farage and nothing much more beyond that.
Because new name and new leader presumably carries a lot of risks with it as well, doesn't it? Rob, I mean, you know, Matthew's spoken about Labour. Conservatives have obviously been the party that's been the most divided over Europe. I mean, I guess one of the suggestions is that David Cameron might, you know, lose his party over this, or that the next Conservative leader at the very least will be a Eurosceptic, if not an outer. I mean, where do you see the Conservative Party's position on this moving forward?
I mean, I think if the referendum, it slightly depends on the margin of victory. I mean, I think if the referendum's close, then the issue's likely to, you know, keep going on. If Boris or other, you know, senior figures in the party are sort of openly campaigning against Cameron, then I think it makes it...
Boris seems to think he's not going, so that seems to be the word, doesn't it?
But I mean, he doesn't seem to be particularly publicly supportive of the Prime Minister's position either. And, you know, a cynic might suggest that he's sort of, you know, looking to follow rather than to lead public opinion on the matter. But I think, you know, there are scenarios where, it, you know, the whole thing could rumble on. But I think if, as we were discussing earlier, if the, you know, the margin of victory is sort of, you know, 10-15 points, if it's like, for the sake of argument, the AV referendum in the last parliament, then the issue, I think, to a large extent, is likely to be put away for, if not a generation, then certainly for a couple of electoral cycles, to the extent that the Tory party will be able to reunify itself. And then, you know, faced with potentially, you know, a kind of a very different UKIP in whatever kind of guise, then there'll be a reconfiguration around that, which I think, in a sense, the Conservatives are well prepared for. You know, ultimately, it's an issue which, you know, is very strongly motivates a small number of quite senior and vocal Conservative activists. But I think broadly, the party would rather be unified and in government, which at the moment, you know, the likelihood would be that it would be after 2020, especially given where Corbyn and the Labour Party
are. It sounds like, even though the EU issue has been the one that's divided the Conservatives rather than Labour, at least in the last 20 years, that we're almost more optimistic about the Conservatives' long-term prospects after it than Labour's. I mean, is that fair? What do you think?
Well, it's not. I think a scenario not unlike the Wilson referendum. You know, when
that's
Wilson
because the Conservatives are in government and strong, and Labour are kind of a bit.
But, you know, Cameron's having the referendum for not dissimilar reasons to Wilson having it in the 70s, and, you know, I think the result of that in the 70s was that whilst Tony Benn continued to bang on about, you know, not liking Europe, that never became a particularly dominant position within the Labour Party, and it more or less went away. The boil was lanced with the referendum, and the Bennites realising that they were on the losing side of the argument.
Of course, a big difference of the 1970s, however, is the extent to which immigration has become entwined with Europe as an issue. And I think, you know, you guys had Stan Greenberg on the podcast series recently, and, you know, the big conclusion from his excellent book, actually, is very much that there will be always a constituency within our generation, at least, if not the one after, for voters who feel that they are distinctly uncomfortable with the social changes that are sweeping through Western states. And I think, you know, unlike 1975, after this referendum, there will be a lot of voters who feel frustrated and angry that they will effectively have to live with free movement for the rest of their lives, and there will be therefore a constituency for those voters, and it will be, you know, interesting to see who picks up that baton and how they run with it.
That was this week's politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. A big thanks to my guests Matthew Goodwin and also, of course, as usual, Rob Vance. Several interesting topics discussed there. It did very much feel like the vibe was that, you know, we expect Britain to vote Remain in the upcoming referendum. But then again, of course, you know, events can take over. But I mean, I guess one of the interesting points that Matthew made there, which I think that often hasn't been made is just because events could produce insecurity in terms of maybe another migrants crisis or a, as Rob mentioned, a sort of another economic crisis. It doesn't necessarily mean that that insecurity would bring Brexit in. If anything, it could mean the reverse. So that's very interesting. And I think that in the end, David Cameron's position as Prime Minister is very, very important here. You know, the Leave campaign are going to have to overcome the fact that the Prime Minister and the business community advocate for Remain. And although, you know, nothing is impossible in these things, you know, it feels much more like the AV referendum, which was comfortably won by the kind of status quo, if you like, rather than the Scottish referendum. And maybe part of that is because the EU referendum, much like the AV referendum, is very much something that was forced on the public by politicians rather than something that they were clamouring for. People might disagree with that, but it certainly feels that way, as opposed to maybe the Scottish independence referendum, which was very much born out of the SNP winning a majority in the Scottish Parliament. But we'll see, and it's something that we're going to be coming back to as Cameron sort of progresses his renegotiation and obviously, you know, takes the argument to the country. Before we go, we'll be looking at, just to talk a bit about what we're going to be looking about in the coming weeks. Next week is the publication of the initial results from the polling inquiry as to what went wrong at the general election. I'm going to be going along to that. Fortunately, managed to get in the room to listen to what the inquiry head, Pat Sturgis, has got to say. Certainly seems that it's going to be along the lines of, you know, whether or not we're getting to the right people in these opinion polls. Potentially, John Curtis was on the BBC today saying that it looks like it's much harder to get Conservative voters into opinion polls and to survey them. And it might be, you know, one of the theories I'm working on is that, you know, it might be that we have to do polling a lot less frequently, take a lot more time over it, and maybe it becomes more of an academic pursuit paid for by universities, much less frequent, much more expensive to do, rather than something that is media-led, which is obviously designed to be quick and cheap. And I suppose quick and cheap, as any researcher will know, is not necessarily going to produce the best results. Also in the coming week, we're going to be looking at UKIP again, hoping to line up some guests to look at their future and what's going on there. I'll have more to say on that once that's all confirmed, but some exciting plans there. And also we're going to be revisiting the US presidential race as we go into Iowa and then later New Hampshire. And for anybody that's new to the podcast who hasn't listened to those episodes on the US election before, definitely recommend the podcast that we conducted before Christmas with Stan Greenberg, who of course worked for Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and also Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband. You know, very experienced pollster for those people that will sort of know about these things. He had a really interesting tip for the eventual GOP nominee and lots of interesting things to say as a result of his book America Ascendant, about how some of the, in his view, some of the demographic changes there are leading to an inevitable Democrat win in November 2016. Maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. And I also spoke to the Huffington Post's Ariel Edwards-Levy a couple of weeks after that. She's a polling director at the Huffington Post and, you know, really knowledgeable, of course, following these things very, very closely. And we talked a little bit about Donald Trump and where his support was coming from and whether he could last. So anybody interested in those things who's maybe new to the podcast, hasn't listened to it before, do check those out. But for now, that's it. All we've got time for this week. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. And do share and tweet and, you know, like our Facebook page and, you know, give us a rating on iTunes and subscribe if you're on iTunes. Anything you can do to support the podcast like that really does help get it out there and, you know, grow our listenership, and, you know, it would be very much appreciated. But for now, thanks for listening, and then stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks.